They'll be landing at 2 o'clock in the morning at Andrews Air Force Base, and I'll be there to greet them.
Three Americans released by the North Koreans are on their way home. This is Thursday, the 10th of May, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, hundreds of villagers who were stranded in the jungle amid clashes between Myanmar's military and ethnic rebels in Kachin State in northern Myanmar are missing. The gap is tightening on Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak as voters go to the polls, and they have now tightened. The National Hockey League again heads to China, all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea has released three American detainees ahead of a planned summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. As VOA's Aisha Sarai reports, Trump says the Americans are on their way home after their release was secured by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
They'll be landing at 2 o'clock in the morning at Andrews Air Force Base, and I'll be there to greet them. Mike will be with me. It will be, I think, a very special time. Nobody thought this was going to happen.
Korean-Americans Tony Kim and Kim Hak-song, who were teaching at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, were separately detained in 2017 and accused of participating in anti-state activities and trying to overthrow the government. The third detainee, Kim Dong-chul, was arrested in October 2015. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison with hard labor in 2016 after being convicted of espionage.
Flying back are three what they were calling hostages. We call them fine people, three really fine people.
The news follows a visit to North Korea by Secretary of State Pompeo, who was in the country to prepare for the upcoming meeting between Trump and Kim. Trump says the location of the summit will be announced soon, adding that the meeting will not be held at the demilitarized zone that separates the two Koreas. Aisha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
We welcome to VOA Asia Alex Gladstein. He is the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation. Alex, thanks for being with us. What was your reaction to the release? Not really a surprise, I take it, right?
Well, first and foremost, we're just very grateful and happy to see the prisoners released. We can only hope they are in good health and that what happened to Otto Warmbier does not happen to them.
How do you think this release figures in to what is to come, at least we think is to come, and that is the talks between Trump and Kim?
Well, it's quite clear that, you know, this is a strategic move by the North Korean dictatorship to help buy them a little bit more time, to help give them a little more leverage. And, you know, their goal, of course, is to prolong and sustain their rule. And I think what's really important for people to look back at is the Sunshine Policy and the six-party talks. We have a lot of evidence here that tells us and shows us what the North Korean dictatorship does after and during, you know, and as a result of quote-unquote talks with other countries. And, you know, the results are in and they're clear, and The results are that the human rights situation inside North Korea and the war, the real war on the Korean Peninsula between the North Korean government, you know, and waged on its people, does not end, and that these talks end up over, you know, the ones we've seen, at least these talks end up bailing out, rescuing, strengthening this really evil government, and we've seen that happen several times in the last few decades.
Do you?
And what happens is the human rights conditions on the ground in North Korea do not get any better.
Do you believe that Kim Jong-un is seriously trying to change his stance as far as how he and his country relate to other countries?
No. Fundamentally, no. I believe you will see Kim Jong-un potentially sell or give away some of the weapon technology, potentially to China. I believe it'll be impossible to verify whether he gives away all of it. I believe you'll see conditions whereby if they do certain things, if they pledge to stop testing, if they pledge to give up some of their weapons, you'll see sanctions reduced, and you'll see a lot of money flowing towards the Kim regime, which is, of course, exactly what they want.
Do you think that the U.S. agenda in these talks have anything to do with human rights or the prisoners that are being incarcerated in North Korea?
My hope is yes, and there is some hope for that based on the fact that Ji Sung-ho, a remarkable North Korean defector, was celebrated at the President's State of the Union address a few months ago, and that both the President and Vice President seem to be sympathetic to the suffering of the North Korean people. But my expectation, unfortunately, is that no, at these talks and the result of these talks will not feature or advance any sort of human rights promotion for the North Korean people.
Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation. My VOA colleague William Gallo talked about the possibility of human rights coming up at the upcoming talks between Trump and Kim with Aiden Foster Carter. Aiden, I would imagine, a senior research fellow in sociology and modern Korea at Leeds University in the UK and a freelance consultant, writer, and broadcaster on Korean affairs.
I'm afraid that I see a precise and negative or inverse correlation between progress in general dialogue with the North Korean regime and human rights. I mean, in the longer term, one hopes it would be different. But I mean, it's the analogy I like to use is presumably when all that Henry Kissinger flew secretly to China all those years ago, he didn't greet Chairman Mao, you know, with "Hello, you mass murderer, how are you today?" You have other goals, and it must be very difficult. But I imagine, never having been a diplomat myself, that you have to prioritize. So they're trying to forge a relationship, first of all, where there is none between the states, I mean, at least informally, and they're trying specifically the U.S. overridingly, other states not perhaps so much. It's the nuclear issue. So you focus on that. I mean, and all the rest, you know, you can't do it all at once. What about human rights? What about state crime, for that matter? I hope somebody has said, are you stopping the cyber heists, you know, which I think have been traced to North Korea, a couple of bank things in Bangladesh and Taiwan, and robbing a Bitcoin exchange in Seoul and so on. I mean, they have to stop all this stuff. I'm afraid human rights goes on the back burner. Anybody must regret that. But I think that's, you know, you've got to do one thing at a time.
We invite you to read more in our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Afghan officials say at least three suicide bombers struck two police stations in the capital, Kabul, Wednesday, wounding at least six. A magnitude 6.2 earthquake has rocked Afghanistan and Pakistan, sending people racing out of buildings in the two capitals. Five police officers were killed, another taken hostage when a riot broke out at a high-security prison on the outskirts of the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. An inmate was also killed in the riot. Japan and China agree to set up a conflict communication mechanism to prevent maritime and aerial incidents over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Hundreds of villagers who are stranded in the jungle amid clashes between Myanmar's military and ethnic rebels in Kachin State, northern Myanmar, have not been heard from. About 2,000 villagers are said to have fled their homes in Kachin because of renewed fighting between the Myanmar military and ethnic Kachin rebels near the border with China. Thousands of ethnic Kachin IDPs, or internally displaced persons in Myanmar, are setting up bamboo shacks, while many others are trapped inside mosquito-plagued jungles as an army offensive against rebel troops in the country's far north rolls into a second month. Kachin community leaders and the United Nations report that at least 6,800 people have fled their homes for safety since the attacks began in early April. Lam Nuomrang Yaw, one of the internally displaced persons from Myanmar's Kachin community, said, "I don't even know how I feel right now. I don't even know what trouble means anymore. The military came and attacked with airstrikes all of a sudden near us, and we just ran into the jungle in different directions." A church near the state capital is caring for hundreds of new arrivals, including some casualties from airstrikes and shelling by government forces. A major rebel group in Myanmar, the Kachin Independence Army, has frequently clashed with government troops following a collapse of a 17-year-old ceasefire in 2001. Happening now in Asia, China claims to have built a system that can predict earthquakes 3 weeks in advance. Reports are saying Hanoi has demanded that Beijing remove military equipment from contested islands in the South China Sea, saying the reported missile installations are a serious violation of Vietnam's sovereignty. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are indeed happy you are with us. Malaysia has been ruled by the same coalition for more than six decades, and many had predicted this would remain the case after voters went to the polls Wednesday, despite a massive corruption scandal embroiling the prime minister. But in a contest riddled with peculiarities, from unholy alliances to allegations of massive election fraud, the gap tightened on Prime Minister Najib Razak. David Boyle filed this report from the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur, before the vote tally was released.
Some friendly political banter in a not-so-friendly election campaign. The supporters of Malaysia's ruling coalition rain on an opposition parade with a drive-by interruption. Marina Mahathir is a captivating campaigner and the daughter of the country's 92-year-old former Prime Minister Mohamed Mahathir, who has come out of retirement to try and take down his old party.
Are we going to make history? Yeah!
She says attempts by the Barisan National-led ruling UMNO coalition to swing the election using underhanded tactics, such as dramatic last-minute alterations to electoral boundaries, are going to backfire.
I think Barisan National has just made a whole series of mistakes. The redelineation made people angry, the anti-fake news law made people angry, and then they announced polling day on a Wednesday, which has never happened before. And that really, really, I think, fired up people and made them mad. And since then, I think people have been so fed up. I mean, because it's disrespectful to the voter, and I think Malaysians don't like to be disrespected by their government in that way.
The Man Marina and the opposition Pakatan Harapan coalition are fighting to bring down, though, Najib Razak is everywhere in Malaysia's electronic media spaces and not one known to shy away from a fight. He stands accused of pocketing hundreds of millions of dollars in one of the world's biggest corruption scandals involving theft from a sovereign wealth fund, 1MDB, that he was chairman of. Few politicians could weather such a scandal, but Najib has doubled down with an enormous campaign expenditure targeted at winning over the party's base in the ethnic Malay majority. Khairi Jamaluddin is one of the rising stars of Najib's party, tasked with reforming its image with younger voters. He is confident that in critical rural strongholds, like out here in Seremban district, national issues such as the 1MDB scandal are not the concerns that cut through.
For those people who live in rural areas and semi-urban areas, there's still a lot of reliance on local representatives to solve local problems. And on that score, we're far ahead of the opposition.
UMNO's commanding lead has reportedly been shrinking fast, but unseating a government that has ruled for more than six decades is a mighty task. David Boyle in Kuala Lumpur for VOA News.
Well, the vote tally is in, and an alliance of opposition parties spearheaded by Mahathir Mohamad won the Malaysian general election on Thursday. At the age of 92, he will become the oldest elected leader in the world. This is VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Despite opposition, Afghanistan rolls out electronic ID cards. The leaders of Japan, China, and South Korea hold a series of meetings in Tokyo. North Korea's nuclear program dominated much of the day's discussion. And an alliance of opposition parties led by former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad won a majority in the lower house election on Wednesday in Malaysia. This is VOA Asia. The National Hockey League has announced it will stage a second pair of exhibition games in China this September. The Boston Bruins and Calgary Flames will face off on September 15th in Shenzhen and in Beijing on September 19th. China has been the target of expansion by other American sports enterprises, including the National Basketball Association and the National Football League. Cody Dushka is marketing director for Ice Hockey Australia in Brisbane. He told Victor Beatty a second year of preseason games in China is the latest sign that the sport is growing across Asia.
They're going pretty gangbusters with the ramping up of the 2022 Beijing Olympics. Obviously, having a hockey team there will they'll need to be a reputable team and be able to compete on a world level. So I think they're growing the sport pretty quickly in their country, and same goes with Australia and throughout Australasia.
Do you attribute the interest in ice hockey and also professional football, like the National Football League and soccer in China, to China's growing wealth?
Yeah, definitely. Not to get too political. They're obviously interested in Western lifestyle, sports, culture, that sort of stuff. So, I guess that, they obviously have a following in the NBA and baseball and that sort of stuff as well. So I think hockey is probably no different from that.
Ice hockey is also growing in popularity elsewhere in Asia, including Australia. Why is that?
It's a growing sport here. We do have our first NHL player playing with the Washington Capitals right now. So Nathan Walker started the season with the Capitals, moved to Edmonton, now back with the Capitals. He's done a lot to grow the sport just in the last year or so. But Australia and ice hockey goes back a long, long ways. I think 1908 is when Ice Hockey Federation was formed. And that's, makes it one of the oldest federations in the world. So we've been playing ice hockey here for a long, long time. I guess our challenge is just need the infrastructure to catch up with the level of interest here.
Cody, what do you hope the 2022 Winter Games in Beijing will do for ice hockey?
Thinking about Australian ice hockey, the biggest thing we need here is, like I said, more infrastructure. So, if some of these teams are coming to Asia or even Australia to train for the 2022 Olympics, that exposure and that experience for those players, and see that ice hockey is a sport in Australia that's being played, it's very popular here, I guess it can only help us out. So we're ramping up for the Olympics as well, so whether that be building rinks or getting our teams to the World Championships, but that is our ultimate aim here, is obviously grow the sport to a much higher level.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a Myanmar policeman now serving a prison sentence gave more details to a court on Wednesday about how he says two Reuters reporters were framed by police. U.S. President Donald Trump said Wednesday he'll announce the site for a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un within 3 days, and that it will not be held at the demilitarized zone along the border between the two Koreas. This is VOA Asia. Now, diabetics who use insulin to control their blood sugars can sometimes end up with some very low readings that, if left untreated, can lead to death. There is modern equipment that monitors the blood. However, there is a new way to do that, which is really quite old, as VOA correspondent Shelley Schlender reports.
Man's best friend, with benefits. These are dogs for diabetics. They're trained to smell dangerous changes in blood sugar levels, then alert their owners. It cost around $50,000 for the organization to train each dog. But for diabetics who qualify, the dogs are free.
This is awesome. I can get a dog to help with my diabetes.
And help they do. This dog named Yancy saved his owner from low blood sugar that could have led to a diabetic coma.
They said to us, the doctor, if he didn't wake you up, you would not have made it.
Mark Rufinacht is the founder of Dogs for Diabetics. He's a diabetic who loves to gather data.
And I'm wearing two continuous glucose monitors as I'm testing out two different brands right now.
One blood sugar monitor shows a reading of 122. The other shows 133. Both readings are in the safe, normal range. So Rufinacht demonstrates how his diabetes dogs smell low blood sugar by using jars containing swabs of sweat from a diabetic who did have low blood sugar. Rufinacht's sweat jar method for training his diabetes alert dogs has been validated scientifically. To train dogs to avoid distracting smells, he uses jars with other scents,
such as peanut butter or dog food or eucalyptus.
But the dogs are not interested in the other smells. This is how they let him know that his blood sugar level is dropping. But because the monitor showed his blood sugar was normal just a few minutes earlier, Rufinacht decides the dogs simply want to play.
So now we're getting a little bit of attention wanting because one dog is getting jealous of the other. Okay. All right. Off. Sit.
And you tell the dog, let's go. Rufinacht continues to explain his training methods. Then suddenly,
disobey the command. What's happening is my blood sugars are dropping. Okay, and that's maybe why they were both alerting at the intensity that they were. Now, 5-10 minutes later, I'm getting the alert that the blood sugars are dropping rapidly.
The same meter that had shown a safe blood sugar level of 133 10 minutes ago, when his dogs first alerted, now shows a blood sugar of 83, a 50-point drop. Rufinacht says the dogs often notice dangerous blood sugars before his meters do.
This is persistence, okay? This is not just pressing a button on my phone and turning an alarm off. This is persistence. Good girl.
Dogs for Diabetes has placed over 100 dogs with diabetics. They hope to expand the program, training humanity's most loyal companion to save lives and help diabetics around the world. Shelley Schlender for VOA News, Concord, California.
A new media channel created by two brothers who are athletes is shining the spotlight on young basketball players and gaining growing attention as this in the sports world. Michael Sullivan spoke with Bradley and Brando Deo. They are the creators of the web-based channel Mars Real.
Top plays by top high school athletes are getting exposure beyond their local communities, thanks to two brothers.
And they're becoming public figures, you know, and other, you know, 12 to 24-year-olds are, you know, looking up to them and following them on Instagram.
And on other social media sites, including Facebook, Snapchat, and Twitter, where the brothers' channel Mars Real has a presence. The brothers started filming their own games when they were high school basketball players.
Mom was a single parent, so we had to get creative, and we said, we're going to buy a camera, we're going to film our own games, and we're going to send it to colleges and see what happens.
In 2010, it became a business. The brothers say exposure makes a difference for young prospects whose games are not covered by the big TV sports channels, players like Zion Williamson, one of the top high school prospects in the country.
But if you're a kid in a small town like, you know, Spartanburg, South Carolina, you're not going to have a big ESPN truck come film your game unless you're like the best thing since, you know, LeBron or Michael Jordan.
NBA star LeBron James is one of their investors. The two brothers employ hundreds of contract video journalists who shoot local games and athletes. Their sites get 25 million online views each month, mostly on mobile devices. They also allow athletes to share their own stories.
As we give different high school athletes around the country an action camera, and with the action camera, they can take it to play pickup in their parking lot.
Or show practices and games, getting attention from college and professional basketball recruiters, while entertaining young sports fans. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This has been VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let us hear from you. We really do want to hear from you at VOA Asia Facebook. Also our email at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter. Our engineer, Jonah Cummings, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our BOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.